to get to be here. I think somebody's gotten taller from the last time that I've used this, I think. It's been a little while. What's that? I probably better nod. I'll probably break it between now and then. I hope everybody's had a good day today. It's getting a little cooler. We may get some frost maybe before the week is out, which is a little bit anxious if you're a gardener and putting things out already, but that's all right. It's going to be a good week, and we're thankful that you decided to be with us today. We are, as for those of you who are in the class know, Bill has finished the series that he had been working on through concerning holiness for a good while now. Uh-oh, did it disappear? There it is. Okay, I pushed the button wrong. We are, and so for now, for the time being, for a few weeks or however long we may decide to let this run, we're going to study and sort of jump back into something that we have done in the past, although have not done this year. And that is to what we've called in the past the peak of the week. And so what we are going to try to do, and I hope that you have taken some time and some interest in participating in our daily Bible reading. If you haven't, we encourage you to do that. As you know, we have done for several years, long before I was here, have done it for many years, a daily Bible reading program. This year's was a little bit different in that it is not a whole Bible plan, but instead is a short and small daily devotional reading that is some selection from either the Old or the New Testament. We're taking the time now to sort of to pick one of our day's readings and to just study something that we have read and take some inspiration from it and take some application from it. And tonight's is going to be from Psalm 126, which is one of the readings from this past week. So if you want to turn there, that's where we're going to spend our time. You also, if you haven't been a part of the Bible reading program so far, this year's program is not one that is dependent from day to day. So in other words, there is no section in which we are reading the entire book of, Deuteronomy, in which you have to read it from day to day. There are separate readings in different places all across. So you can pick it up today. You can start, and you will have missed some of the readings, but you will not have missed. It's easy to pick it up and read, so there's no definite plan along the way. So today is as good a time of any for you to pick up your Bible reading plan, and you can start reading with us. Bill and I have enjoyed this plan so far. I think I can speak for him. Though it is not necessarily a continuous reading from day to day, it doesn't mean that there isn't a line of thought that is put by the publisher, and that the publishers and the editors have organize the scriptures in such a way that it makes it interesting and fun and challenging to try to find what that line of thought is. And I hope, we're not going to talk about it at the beginning, but I hope that when we finish tonight, I'll maybe give you an example of what we mean by that. And I hope that maybe you'll take some time and make some time, if you've heard me before, make some time to do your daily Bible reading. You can do it. Everyone can do it. It's not as hard as we make it out to be. So we're going to spend our time tonight in one of our readings this past week from Psalm 126. That's where we're going to be, 126. If you notice, usually at this time we usually talk about several of the readings and sort of make mention of the readings that we have done over the past week. I'm not going to do that now. We're going to instead do that at the end of our class today to maybe give you a little bit of a help to see what we mean by when we say that there is a line of thought. If you notice in your Bibles, many of them will say there is a superscription at the beginning of this particular psalm. There are some of those all the way from Psalm 120 through Psalm 135. And each of the superscriptions is the beginning of the psalm, is written a song of ascents, a song of ascents, or the song of ascending. There's not really anybody who knows for sure what exactly that means. There's a lot of different guesses, and a lot of people have different ideas of them. I think the most plausible and the one that seems the most applicable to me, especially when we read this particular psalm, is that when we say that this is a song of ascents, we're talking about the psalm or the recitation or the singing of a hymn on the way to Zion, on the way to Jerusalem, as they are traveling toward the city to participate in one of the great feasts. So the many different feasts in which they were required to travel to Jerusalem and participate in some of the offerings or the feasts. So this is one of the ones that is said that they would have sung along the way. There are some interesting that are called, in one of them, there's an ancient sort of a Jewish tradition that is called the Song of the 15 Steps, in which there were 15 steps from one court of the temple to the next. And so there was a song for each step that you would sing as you walked up toward the temple to worship. So in essence, it's kind of a preparation for worship. It's a song that helps to gear a person's mind toward thinking about not only what the Lord has done, but what the Lord is doing and what the Lord will do, and then being able to give praise as a result of that. And so that's where we are at the beginning. Psalm 126 is one of those 15, Song of 15 Steps, and that we're going to talk about tonight. Let's go ahead and take just a minute and let's read it. It's only six verses, and so it will be a short read, and then heavy on application and heavy on thoughts to think about as we read. Let's read together Psalm 126, a song of ascents. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with shouts of joy. And then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and for that we are glad. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow in tears shall reap with shouts of joy. He who goes out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. Psalm 126. That's taken from the ESV. I'm going to read and teach from the New King James Version, though they're very similar, but just a few little different wordings for today. I got I've divided it up into four different sections here, even though it's only six verses. There are four different lines of thought that to me are present in just a short little tune. Let's start at the very beginning. Very simple. Let's talk about the fact that this is a song of redemption. That's really small up there. You can see it better over here, so look at this one instead. It's a little brighter. The song of redemption is the song, Psalm 126. It begins by giving us the context of this. The ESV says that when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion. In the other versions, it simply says when the Lord brought back the captivity of Zion. We were like those who dream. What we're dealing with here, most likely and is most probable, that we're dealing with people who have come back from captivity. What captivity would we be talking about at this time? Would you know? I'm sorry? This would be the captivity, the great exile that the people of Israel were sent from Judah, from Jerusalem and captive and sent off to Babylon. Many of them killed in the city. Many, many more of them taken to Babylon to become slaves in the court of King Nebuchadnezzar and in the nation, and so of course sent all over the nation, all over their empire to become slaves and servants in that place. 586 BC, if you're a historian, one that you can read about, or thereabouts, 586, and all of this theme of captivity. When we say that this is a song of redemption, we're talking about this theme that runs all over biblical literature. From all the way back to, say, from the beginning to the end, from the theme of the Exodus, right? When the people are sent over to be slaves in Egypt, and then God comes into Egypt and brings his people out. We're talking about redemption of a source. And we're talking about it in the historical writings. It's probably found most often in probably the prophetic writings, where all of the message of the prophets, many of their messages are, you're being disobedient, you are not following the Lord. He's going to exact some judgment on you, and you're going to suffer because of it. But in nearly all of them, there is this message of, however, the Lord is going to take care of his people, and he will be there to restore you. And he will be there to reach out and to bring you back. And he will be there to come and to get you in whatever writings we might read them. Lots of them in the book of Isaiah, lots of them in the book of Jeremiah, lots of them in the book of, and many of the minor prophets. The idea of redemption is one that covers all of the many, many, many of our books in the book of biblical literature. Though they'll be taken captive, he will be there to bring his people back. There is a writer who wrote a book that I had to read in school. That's one that's meant a lot to me because it's very informative and it paints really good pictures of historical background for what things mean. And Leon Morris is his name. If you're a commentary reader, you might recognize his name. About a generation ago, he wrote a book simply called The Atonement. And in the book called The Atonement, he takes sort of an approach to say there's a whole bunch of words that the Bible uses to describe how God, for lack of a better term, how God saves his people. So in other words, he would write a chapter to say, for example, why would Paul use the term propitiation to describe what Jesus does for his people? And he gives a background for what the word means in context and how people would use it. And so it gives a clearer meaning of why that word would mean so much to Paul, for him to use it so often to describe the work of the cross. One of the things that he has a whole chapter on, one of the words he has a whole chapter on, is the idea of redemption and what it means and how it was used by the people of that day and why it means so much when we talk about God redeeming his people. He tells a story of how in the ancient times, when there would be wars and fights among nations, most often, as is the case with Babylon and with Nebuchadnezzar and with Judea and with Jerusalem, that when the victorious nation or people or tribe or whatever it might be, upon their winning the battle, oftentimes they would take captive, most of the time, some important people. So like when Nebuchadnezzar came in 606 to Jerusalem and he sort of put a siege on the city and he captured a whole lot of people and he took people like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego back to Babylon to become his slaves. That's an example of what would happen during those days. And so many of them would be taken back. Sometimes it'd be important people. Sometimes it'd be poor people. Sometimes people would be killed. But oftentimes people would just be rounded up and marched the 800 or 900 miles back to where the country's from, and they would become slaves to that country. What happens sometimes is that the people that are left, who were not taken captive, sometimes are left without a leader, or left having the people that were so important to them are no longer part of their crew. And so needing to get some of those people back, the idea essentially was the soldiers or the people of that land would basically pass the hat. And they would gather up a sum of money so that they might be able to get a large enough sum of money to where they would be able to say, we want to send this money to that nation so that we can buy back the prisoner that you took from us. Interestingly, the money that they gathered together and that they pulled into the helmet or the hat or whatever and got it ready to take was called in their language the ransom. It was the ransom price. And when they took the ransom price and they gave it to a certain individual and they told him to go to that country and plead and beg to those leaders so that we can have our king or our nobleman or whoever it might be, the person that's really important to us, we want him back, take the money, take the ransom, take it over there, plead with them to get him back, and then pay so that we can buy him back. Do you know what they called the guy who carried the money? He was called the Redeemer. He was called the Redeemer. The person who carried the money and said, this guy's really important to us. We want him back. Here's what you desire for it. Give him back to us. That is redemption. That's the process of redemption. And so when we get this idea and we try to make this application for what for you and I, it gives us a really clear picture. And when we make the application for what we're talking about here, it gives us, illustrates several different things for us. So let's think about some things of what it means that we can think about in terms of redemption. So in this particular place, when the Lord brings his captives back from Zion, it tells us that the redeemed have tremendous worth in the eyes of the Redeemer. Because they're not going to pass the hat and collect a whole bunch of money from people whose money, who probably have very little because the people took it from them. They're not going to collect all of this money and then go dangerously into the people who just destroyed your city and beg and plead to have some people back if that guy is a bum, essentially, right? If we don't care about the slaves that you took, if it doesn't matter, we're not putting ourselves in danger to go do that. The idea is the Redeemer sees the person who is captive as somebody who is very important and who is extremely worthwhile, and we care and are concerned about that person. And so when you think about it in terms of just that picture, think about it in terms of the way God would see these people. This is exactly what happened, right? When he sent them to Babylon because of their disobedience, and he told them Nebuchadnezzar's going to come, Judah's going to be burned, you're going to have to suffer, and you're going to go into captivity, but promised them all along, I will come and get you. God is not going to deal with them if they don't mean something to him. And he said all along, you are my people. I am your God. I'll come and I will receive you again and I will bring you home and I will make you my people and I will become your God again because I've called you out of Egypt. I've promised you for all of these years over and over and over and over and over again. This is God's way of getting through to these people. And so God makes a sacrifice so that he can bring his people back. And that's the application when we think about for you and for me. For him to sacrifice a son and to send him as a redeemer to buy the people back who've been caught in captivity shows the fact that we are of tremendous worth in the eyes of a God, even though we are just like these people and are really not worthy of that, right? We're not worthy of that. But the Lord sees us as worthy. He sees us as worth something, enough for him to make a sacrifice of his own son and send him as redeemer to bring us back. And that's the idea that we get. So we have this idea that the redeemed have tremendous worth in the eyes of the redeemer. I think if you look at the rest of, or at the next verse in the psalm, right? So when the Lord brought back the captivity of Zion at the end of verse 1, we were like those who dream, and then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Notice the reaction of the people. The redeemed are astonished that the Redeemer would think of them this way. They say, the Lord has brought us back, brought us, he has come and he has delivered us from captivity, and it's too good to even be true. It's like we're dreaming. This is our dream. It's been this way for a long time. We have dreamed of going back home. We never thought it would ever happen again. 70 years they had to be in Babylon, many of them. That's plenty enough time to develop a negative attitude and to develop an attitude that says, well, I guess we're never going home, right? Which is what many of them felt. To just resign themselves to say, we're here. We're stuck here. Judah and Jerusalem are no more. Especially once the city is burned to the ground and destroyed. Many of them gave up hope. And so for them to say the Lord has brought back the captivity of Zion, it's like we're dreaming. This is too good to be true. And he said it's so much so that our mouth was filled with laughter, right? In other words, we're laughing because we can't believe it. We can't believe what has just happened. They are astonished that the Redeemer has thought so much of them because they recognize their unworthiness. They recognize. And so think about when it comes to, how difficult it would be or how astonishing it would be to, if you're a person who's living in Babylon and you've been a slave and some of the older folks have been there 70 years, and then this other ruthless leader shows up and conquers Babylon. His name is Cyrus. He's with the Medes and the Persians. The emperor of them, or the leader of the Medo-Persian Empire, shows up and conquers Babylon, becomes a leader of this nation, and then says, what are you guys doing here? I think it's time for you to go home. And the person who ruthlessly has conquered the world shows up and says, y'all people, you can just go on home. Of course, we know it is prophecy from Isaiah, and it's the plan of God to anoint this man to say, I'm going to use him to get my people back home. But if you're a person living here, what more astonishing thing could there be that this ruthless guy says, you know, I guess we feel bad for you. Here's all of the stuff that Nebuchadnezzar stole from you. Here's everything that came from the temple. Here's some extra money. Here's some goats and lambs and animals that you're going to need when you get there. Go on home. See you later. And you get to go. Who would not be astonished if you're in that position? Now think about it in terms of our redemption. When we think about our own situation, if we think about ourselves as being a redeemed people, an individual who's redeemed by God, how do we compare when we think about our redemption in terms of what these people would think about in their redemption? Is our redemption one in which we take pride, or we feel, you know, as something that we have earned, or that we are worthwhile of it? Or is it something that, when thought about, as these people, to say, I laugh at how silly it is that he would consider me even remotely worthy. I am amazed. I am astonished that he would look at me and say, yeah, you're worthwhile to me. Because that's the difference between oftentimes, and it's easy because we live in a country where we feel entitled and where we feel, you know, that we are worth something. And we have a God who says, you are worthwhile to me, so much so that I'm sending my son for you. Are we the people who say, there's no chance that that's true? And I'm astonished that he would ever think that. Or are there we people that feel pride as a result of it? There's a difference between the two, and it's easy. These people, of course, have the great example for us to be people who are astonished that something would happen. They were laughing, and they needed, when they're moved, and if you read through here, they were, our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Great, great, great gratitude, right, for the fact that this has happened. Great and tremendous gratitude, a real sense of humility, that he would even think of me, let alone sacrifice for me and redeem me. So we've got the fact that these people are worth a lot in the eyes of the Redeemer. We have the fact that they are astonished at the Redeemer's actions. But if you keep and sort of build off of this and understand it, we sort of have an understanding that the people have a redeemed, the people who are redeemed have a realistic understanding of why they need a Redeemer. Because they've been slaves for 70 years. If you've been a slave for 70 years, you understand what it means to be in bondage. And you understand how big of a deal it is for you to have no freedom and to truly be under the arm of an oppressor, under the hand of an oppressor. These people understood it because that's where they lived for many years. What we want to say is understand that, to truly understand that we are slaves, that we live in bondage to sinfulness, right, before we have a Redeemer. And so in order to appreciate and be astonished by what the Redeemer does, and in order to understand how much worth I have in the eyes of God, I've got to understand how big of a deal it is that I really am in bondage to slavery, in bondage to sin, and that it really is an oppressor to me, and to know the situation is beyond my control. That for me as a person who is sinful, to have no control in and of myself to get out of that. To be able to say, I am under a taskmaster of sin that will not be able to relent. And won't be able to move it at all by my own power or initiative. But only by the fact that the Redeemer said, I'm here to bring you out of it. And we can truly only appreciate and understand that if we realize how big of a deal it is for us that we were, as Paul would say in Ephesians 2, you were dead in your trespasses and your sins, and yet through Christ you have been made alive together. It's only because of God who made the decision to do that. And so we have all of these ideas in the beginning of this, that we have a song of redemption. Let's look at the second verse. Turn the second half of verse 2. A song of redemption, but I think it's also a song of reflection. It's a song of reflection. If you notice, they say after we have our mouth has been filled with laughter and after our tongues with singing, the people said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. And then the people stop and the writer says, yes, the Lord has done great things for us. And for that we are glad and we are happy. If you notice, what God does among his people draws the attention first of who? Other people, right? The people who are not the ones being blessed. The ones who are on the outside looking in. And the nations are caused because of God's work for his people and because of God's work among his own people. Those that are on the outside take notice. And they realize and they are forced to stop and say, the Lord is doing great things among that group of people. It's amazing, and we have been studying with our young people on Sunday mornings and on Wednesday nights often as well. We have been taking some time to do what is essentially an overview of the Bible, sort of a cursory look at, you know, the main themes of the Bible, and reading many of the stories from all of our books and from many of the prophets and all of the historical books. And what we've attempted to do is to trace not only the basic, you know, individual stories that we read and the individual lessons that come from those, but what we have attempted to do is to look at those individual stories and then kind of take a step back and what the author of our study calls the upper story, by taking back and looking at it from God's perspective and being able to say, here's how these individual events fit into the larger scheme of what God is trying to do, and that is bring his people back to himself and redeem his people. And in reading that, it's been something that for me, I've been really, really impressed, more so than I've ever been, at how many times God speaks of the importance that the nations see his work among Israel, if that makes any sense. How many times God says, I am doing this, and then they will know that I am the Lord. Or if you do thus and such, and you live in this way and obey in this way, people will see me and the power of my power among you. Over and over and over again. It goes from all the way, you can read about it, all the way back to Abraham, right? And in the stories of Abraham and Lot and what God promises for them. You can go back and you can read in the conquest of Canaan, where God would say, I'm going to show my power and people will see me working among you. And you can go back and you can read in the historical books, in the lives of many of the kings, Hezekiah and Josiah and Manasseh even, where God talks about showing his power. You can go back and you can read it in the story that we just talked about, in the story of Nebuchadnezzar, in which God shows his power through Daniel and the three men, and Nebuchadnezzar is brought to his knees and has to admit, your God is the true God. It happens again when Daniel's in the lion's den, and Darius has to stand up and say, your God is the true God. Over and over and over again, God places so much emphasis on saying, I am going to work among you, and the world will see me if you will allow me to work among you as my people. Over and over and over again, his actions and his presence among the people all along were meant to be seen so that he could be glorified. And it has to be that these people have to allow him to work in this way. And they have to be the people, especially in the times of the judges and the historical books and the kings, in which God would say, for example, like with Hezekiah, for him to be able to say in his prayer at the end of his, near the end of his, when Sennacherib has surrounded the army or surrounded the city and the Assyrians are about to take over, and Hezekiah goes with Isaiah and he bows in the temple and he prays and he says, God, if you will deliver us, if you will destroy Sennacherib, everyone will know that you are the true God. Everybody will see it. And that's exactly what God does. He shows 185,000 people die in their sleep that night as they surround the city, and Sennacherib gets up and goes home. And everybody wonders what happened, and everybody knows that it is God who is behind it. It's interesting and noteworthy that it's always his actions, right? That it is always God's actions that bring, that people notice first. There are, you know, that changes a little bit, especially when you get to the New Testament and Jesus says things like, let your light shine before men that they may see your good works, so they may see what you are doing. But then he also brings it right back and says that they might see your good works and that God might be glorified through that. And so the eyes of the world tend to be on God's people. And the question we might really very simply ask is, you know, is God seen at work among his people by those that are around us? And so you have the first, the people that are looking. It's a worthy question to ask. Is his, you know, is his power and his presence, are the fruits of his spirit, the grace and the peace and love and kindness and gentleness, are they evident among his people so that when the people look at, when the world and the nations look at his people, they are able to say, God is present and working in that group of people? It's a worthy question to ask. And so, but also the opposite is true. And so you have the fact that the nations reflect on God's power, but you also have the fact that God's people are moved to reflect on what God is showing among them. Because the very next verse, right, they say, the Lord, the nations have said in verse 2, the Lord has done great things for them. And then the Lord also, they realize, has done great things for us. It's true, he has also been present among us, and we can say we are glad because he's present among us. Sometimes it takes somebody else to maybe poke or prod and help us to see things that are right in front of our eyes but that we fail to recognize sometimes. Have you been in one of those situations before where somebody from the outside has to help you realize that? There are instances in the Old Testament when we read through those stories. For example, when, do you remember when they went to Jericho and the people get to the edge of the river and Joshua sends the two spies in? And when they get there, they find Rahab, and Rahab hides them on the roof from the people who have come. And when they go to the roof, the men begin to speak and Rahab interrupts them. And do you remember what Rahab said to the spies? Do you remember? Before she says, remember me, the reason she says, remember me, is she said, we know that the Lord has given you the city because we watched him bring you. We've heard of what he has done. We know that he brought you out of Egypt. And we know that he has brought you across the Red Sea. And we know that he has given you the city. And she has a big, long discourse, about 5 or 6 verses maybe, to the men. What an encouragement if you're the spies who are sent into this wicked city and the first person you meet says, oh, it's yours, we know. We already know what your God has done. There are places over and over again. Remember when Gideon goes to the, when he's not quite sure that God is really with him yet, he's still not convinced of what's happening, and he goes down into the, God says, go into the camp at night and I want you to listen. And he listens to these two men tell about their dream, and they dream of this large wheel of, is it wheel of cheese or wheel of bread? If you're a Gideon story, it slipped my mind. Something, this large roll of something rolls down the hill and runs through the camp, and the men wake up and say, I've had a dream. Gideon's going to defeat us. And somehow they get this interpretation of the large rolling thing through the camp. They are sure that they are toast and God is going to be with. What a great encouragement if you're Gideon and then you hear this from God. And he's convinced that's the last straw, in which Gideon says, we know it now. We're strong. Think about, if you go further, there's this passage, the story of the wicked prophet Balaam. Do you remember Balaam and Balak and the story with the talking donkey and all of that? Balaam is the wicked prophet who's been asked to curse Israel, and they go up on the mountain, and Balaam, instead of cursing him, do you remember what he says? He stands up and he looks and he says, we have to say of Israel that, oh, what God has done for these people. All the while, the Israelites are in the valley fighting and arguing and complaining the whole time. They can't get along, and they can't obey, and they can't get things right. And the wicked prophet on top of the mountain says, man, God is with those people. Sometimes it takes somebody to poke and prod and help us realize. I remember when we moved to West Virginia, there was we met some people who also had just moved there, and they were he and his wife, they were city folk. They had lived in L.A. and San Francisco, and they moved to rural West Virginia from there for whatever reason. So they were in West Virginia, and we went to their house for dinner one night, and we were sitting on their little back patio, and he stood up, and his eyes got this big around, and he said, that's amazing! And we sort of looked at each other and said, what's he talking about? And they said, this is unbelievable! And he ran off of the porch out into the yard, and he caught a lightning bug. And he brought it back up, and we said, what are you doing? He said, it's a lightning bug. And we said, yeah, it's a lightning bug. He said, I've never seen one before. What are you saying? He said, we don't have them in it. We live in L.A. in San Francisco. We don't have lightning bugs in L.A. And it made us to stop and say, boy, we miss the little blessings, don't we? Of the things that made him appreciate, the things that he appreciated. Never, he was like a little kid. He was catching lightning bugs. He was so proud. And we said, boy, sometimes it takes somebody from the outside to help us realize what we're missing and the things that we really are blessed with. And so it's a song about reflection. Much time do we have? All right, we got 5 minutes. We can do it all in 5 minutes, can't we? So if we, two more things. These can be quick, and then we'll finish. Keep on reading. This is also a song of reaffirmation. Keep on reading. The Lord has done great things, and we are glad. Verse 6, they stop and they say, bring us back our captivity. Bring back the captivity, Lord, as the rivers in the Negev or as the streams in the south. They stop and they begin to reaffirm that, God, you have blessed us, and we realize that. It's an expression to God of, you have brought us this far, and we trust that you will continue to bless us. Because if you remember, not in relatively speaking to how many people went to Babylon, relatively speaking, not very many came back. And so there's this relatively small group of people trying to rebuild a city and rebuild a temple and get things back in order again. And they've got people who are, from the books of Ezra and Nehemiah that are pestering them and not letting them build and constantly being annoying to them and trying to prevent them from what they're doing. This is the prayer to God. You have brought us this far. Maybe you could send us some more, right? And so it's the joy of the fact that he has delivered us. And we realize what he has done, but we are going to put confidence in you that you are going to continue to do this. Can you send us some more people, essentially, is what it is. I read this, a great quote along these lines, where they are moved with gratitude. They're moved to trust that God will continue to provide. A commentator by the name of Hastings says, God's beginnings are a sure promise of the end. We are not rightly grateful for what has been done if we are not emboldened by it to look at what he is yet to do. In other words, part of being thankful for what he has done is being hopeful and confident that he will continue to do. And this is essentially what they're doing. It's a song to reaffirm, to say, you've done a lot for us, and we're confident that you will keep doing. Let's look at the last section, verses 5 and 6. It turns quite quickly, doesn't it? The feel and of the psalm turns from joy, in which he says, but those who sow in tears will be those who reap in joy. And he who continually goes forth weeping, bearing seed for sowing, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with them. It's a statement, it's a song of reality. It's a song in which the people have to stop and say, you have redeemed us. We are astonished that you have thought this much of us. We are grateful for it, and we are moved to gratitude and thankfulness and reflection because of what you have done for us. We're confident that you will be with us, but we also realize that it's not a bed of roses either, that life is not always easy, and that there are, just because you brought us home doesn't mean that this is the end of the journey and everything is great. Just because we've got our city back doesn't mean now that we can just sit back and kick our feet up and enjoy things, because we've got a lot of work to do, and some of that work requires tears. And there's a lot of work to do, and some of that work requires us to weep, right? But the confidence from the people is, we know that you've blessed us, and we know that times are going to be rough because it's life. But we are still confident that even though we are going to go out and sometimes have to sow in our tears, we know that we will reap in joy. And we know that there are times that we will weep while we are sowing our seeds. We know that there will be times where we'll be able to gather the sheaves and reap with joy and with laughter, and that we will come again with rejoicing. It's a statement of reality to say life is not going to always be great. But Even through the rough times, there is always good on the other end of the rough times. And if you're curious, this is the passage from which Knowles Shaw, who was a Restoration Movement preacher back in the 1800s, this is the passage from which he took the great song that we sing, Bringing in the Sheaves. He was a preacher in Restoration Movement churches, was tragically killed in a train accident, of all things, on his way to, he was the singing evangelist. He would travel the world and sing with people and teach them the gospel through his singing. And this is one of his songs taken from Psalm 126 about bringing in the sheaves. We shall come rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves. All right, let's take just a minute as we close. There is a lot, if you are thinking about your reading, and if you've done the reading, think about it in this way. If you haven't, this will give you an idea of what we're looking at. A song of redemption. A song about God caring for a people who are not worthy, although in his eyes we are worthy. If you have read last week and the week before this, we read the entire book of Jonah. And if you've read the entire book of Jonah, it's a little bit of an obscure, strange story in some ways. It's less about a man who's disobedient, I think, and more about God showing his concern for people who are not worthy. And trying to convince a man that everybody needs to hear the message that God has. Because the whole book is about him trying to send them to Nineveh, to the people who are wicked, and to convince Jonah that Nineveh is worthy of hearing. They're worthy of us. They're worthy of your going to them. And so we read the entire book of Jonah, to which is followed a psalm about people who are not worthy, though God sees us as worthy, because he's there as the Redeemer. For the next 3 days, we read three passages, all of which have something to do with each other. John 12 and Luke 19 are the stories of Jesus and the triumphal entry in the beginning of the last week of his life, and so Zechariah chapter 9 is, of course, the prophecy from which John 12 and Luke 19 come, about the man riding on the colt, the foal of a donkey. And so we have a prophet dealing with a people who's not worthy and convincing the prophet that they are worthy. We have a psalm about a people who's not worthy and astonished that God would think of them as worthy. And he brings them a redeemer, and he sends a redeemer to bring them back. And the last three that we've read, that's the redeemer coming. The redeemer showing up in the city riding as the king to bring his people back. And during that week, of course, we know it culminates in the fact that he dies a cruel death and rises again to be the first fruits of the resurrection to which we all share. The Redeemer to bring us, unworthy, back into relationship with him because he's considered us that. That's the kind of stuff you can look at and try to trace the lines through. Take some time this week, pick up a study. The new quarter is it out there? The new quarter is out there. You can pick it up. It starts in April. But the old ones, I think there's some old ones there too. You can pick some of those up and start today. And if they're not, let me know. We'll print them before you leave, and you can take some old ones. Thank you all for your attention tonight. Let's go ahead and we'll have a prayer, and then we'll be dismissed. God, we are most grateful.